Mike Causey, welcome to your turn. As always, really glad to have you with us. Going to have an interesting show today. We'll be talking about a variety of things, up to and including our recent bad weather, really bad weather in some places, and sequestration and whatnot. But first off, we're launching what we hope is a series of shows about federal occupations. Most people know that the government is into just about everything, but there are a lot of things that the government is into that we don't know about, and there are a lot of occupations, and it's some very interesting ones. And we're kicking off today with air traffic controllers, and our timing couldn't have been better, either that or weather personnel. My guest is Trish Gilbert. She is National Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Trish, are you there? Hey, thank you for being on. I know it's usually busy for you, particularly a time like this. Harry, a couple of last days, huh?
It has been. It's been very interesting, to say the least, and I'm very, very proud of the men and women that were able to work before the storm and right now in the aftermath, making sure that we keep the system running safely and get the search and rescue and appropriate supplies into those areas that were hit hard.
I'm sure a lot of people were sleeping at the office, too, huh?
Oh, sleeping, you mean staying in?
Staying over, yeah.
Yeah, we had many of our facilities where our members could not get in to relieve those in the buildings, in the air traffic facility, so they stayed working double shifts through the night to keep, some eyes and ears on the operation to ensure that they were available to help move planes in and out of airports.
Well, like a lot of people, I was glued to the TV, and I did not lose power, luckily for me. But I was watching one segment, and they showed a map of the United States, and it showed all of the air traffic at that moment. And it looked like there were planes literally everywhere, and they had to bring a number of them down because certain airports weren't receiving anymore.
Correct. And they also had to, there was a lot of activity in moving planes away from airports and putting them in alternate areas to keep them from being damaged as well.
It's the kind of job I can't imagine. I've been in a center and I've been in an air traffic control tower, but I don't know much more about it than the average person. What does it take to become an air traffic controller? What kind of background and education do you need?
Initially, you have to score very high on an entrance exam. Many of our controllers right now come either out of the military, in which case they have a military experience in air traffic control. But if they don't, then they have to score well on an entrance exam. Many of those come from our controller training initiative schools. There's about 135 across the country. If they do well on that entrance exam and are hired, they go to our academy in Oklahoma City, where they have to also pass there. And then they spend 3 to 5 years in a facility, and they receive on-the-job training. And at that point, they have several more job jeopardy certification points where they have to be successful or they are not able to continue on with the air traffic control career. But once they're fully certified, then they're hopefully they're in it for 25 to 30 years.
And this is one of those jobs, one of those federal jobs, where there is a mandatory retirement age.
Correct. Age 56, you are mandatorily supposed to retire. Some of our membership stay in the occupation in other parts of the FAA, whether they go into staff specialist jobs through quality assurance or training and other aspects of needs in the FAA, they will go there. But working operationally as an air traffic controller, you must leave at age 56.
Well, I knew going way back when many of the people came out of the military, they were certified there and trained there. And at the time, most of them were men. How about women in the air traffic control workforce, including yourself?
Those numbers are getting larger. The percentages are growing. The job is very stressful, and regardless of race or gender, it takes a great commitment to any individual deciding to do this job. Typically, yes, the hiring pool was the military, so you have a great deal of males in the workplace, still about 83% and only about 16.5% female. But that is changing to a great degree.
shortly after 9/11, the attacks, when they literally, you guys had to clear the skies, I was out in Las Vegas at a meeting of the Federal Managers Association's FAA people. But these people were all controllers who had moved up into the management ranks. And some of the stories, this was a month after 9/11, some of the stories were fascinating. And one manager, said that on the day of 9/11, she had dropped her children off at daycare, and she reported for work, I guess, pretty early. I think she was in Atlanta. And when she walked in, they said, at least two planes have hit the World Trade Towers in New York. The Pentagon has been hit. They thought the CIA and the State Department had been hit. They said there were something like 140 unidentified aircraft heading toward the Washington area. The president had just taken off from Florida, where he was visiting that school group, and the Air Force One was being trailed by an unidentified aircraft. And have a nice day. That was her welcome to the workday. Where were you on 9/11?
I had an afternoon shift that day. I came in, I think, about noon. So the events, and noon, that was in Central Time. So Houston Center is where I worked. Talking to many individuals, that's exactly what happened. Whether they were on sector or just arriving to work, they were told either, you know, do what you can to help the controllers in position to get all aircraft on the ground. But by the time I got in, the only planes that were still in the air were military planes. And it was a first time I'd seen, and I was in, I guess, about 15 years in my occupation at the time. And we have trained to clear airspace before, but we've never really had to do it, and certainly not of that magnitude. But, you know, the controllers were able to get that done very, very quickly and very safely. The one incident that, you know, the next couple days after 9/11, the airspace remained sterile, with the exception of some military operations. So virtually no planes were in the skies over the U.S. for several days. And as you know, many were diverted into Canada. Specifically is the one I want to tell you about. Diverted to Canada, and a lot of people had to stay there for several days. I was working the first sector in the Houston Center's airspace when they let the planes fly again a couple days after the event, and I greeted a Continental Airlines flight coming back to Houston, and Continental Airlines, their hub was Houston, and when I greeted him into my sector, I said, you know, welcome home. And he was visibly—you could hear him choked up and said, "You have no idea how comforting that is, and how glad we are to be home." So, you know, it was a tough couple of weeks, and it certainly the aviation industry has never been the same since that day. And we all certainly look at our professions in a different light since then.
I think that's true for just about all of us. That changed everything forever. I had some friends who were on a flight. They were detoured to Newfoundland, and they stayed with some people. They remained friends with them to this day, but it was just mind-boggling. Do you remember how many aircraft were in the air at that time?
Say about 4,000, because it was still fairly early in the morning on the western side of the United States. Any given time, there's 5,000 or so airplanes in the air. But about that time, I think it was about 4,000.
Wow. Okay. We've gone to the extreme from 9/11. And this very weekend, this week, with this monster storm that really shellacked New York and New Jersey and the eastern shore of Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia. How about this weekend? What were things like?
Well, things from the air traffic perspective, it went as smoothly as it possibly could. You know, there's a lot of damage to a lot of the airports up and down the East Coast. Our team, meaning our membership and the people that I represent, have worked very collaboratively with the FAA and all those on the airport to ensure that those that needed to be there could get there, and those that needed to be home with their families were able to do that with volunteers that took their place to be in the positions to keep the system running. But I can't say enough how working collaboratively with the FAA and other entities really, really made for an easier transition through this storm, and certainly is going to help us as we try and recover at our airports.
Well, I think a lot of times people forget, and I include myself in this, and you think if Chicago or Atlanta go out, big centrally located airports, then that makes things tough. But it doesn't really matter who goes out, does it? If a New York or a Washington or a Baltimore goes out, that has a rippling effect too, I assume.
Absolutely. The 15,000-plus flights that have been canceled has an impact across the globe, not just in the U.S. Certainly, the effects were felt worldwide.
Urban myth confirmed, but I need to take a short break here, but I want to ask you about language when we come back, talking with Trish Gilbert of National Air Traffic Controllers Association. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey. I'm talking with Trish Gilbert. She is Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Trish, before we took a break, I was talking about language. It seems to me I read some time ago, and it's maybe an urban myth, that all the world's air traffic control is done in English.
That is correct.
That's fascinating. So someone, an air traffic controller in China or Cuba or wherever, must be proficient in English.
Yes, they are supposed to be, and we strive for that. However, we do have a lot of activity around improving the language barrier issues that we encounter across, the globe, and certainly in the U.S. when we have foreign pilots in and out of our airports. We have a group actively working that issue to ensure that we're doing everything that we can to make sure that there are no breakdowns in communication with regard to language.
Fascinating. We're talking about 9/11 and most recently the hurricane or tropical storm or Snowmageddon, Sandy, whatever you want to call it. Probably a silly question, but what is a typical day for an air traffic controller? And how about things like breaks? I know this is an extremely nerve-wracking job. I'm talking about rest breaks and that sort of thing. What's a typical day like?
Day is, it's going to vary depending on the type of facility you work at and certainly the shift you're working. Some shifts are busier than others. Some facilities are busier than others. I worked at a en route air traffic control center at Houston, Texas, which is one of our larger facilities. We have about 20 across the country, just over 20 across the country. Houston Center went from Junction, Texas to Pensacola, Florida, up into the Dallas-Fort Worth area down into the Gulf of Mexico. I worked the far east side of that. A typical day coming in would depend on whether I was having to train an individual or I was going to work by myself. And being that we have about 4,000 of our 15,000 air traffic controllers right now in training, there is still a great deal of training, and certainly when I was working in the operation, a lot of training occurring. So that was really a big focus of the operation. So a typical day usually included some training. It also included some training on that you might have to take because we also are trying to deploy a lot of technology and change of airspace and procedures to make the system more efficient. So there's a lot of that occurring as well, so quite a strain on the operation. And typically without all of those extra things happening, you would come in, make sure that you were up to date on any of the information that was needed for this airspace, whether it was airport closures or weather, significant weather issues or equipment outages. So you were up to date on that. You would then plug in, work approximately an hour and a half to 2 hours before you would take a break. You take some time out of the operational environment, 15 to 30 minutes, and then come back in and do it all again until you were done. Now, that is a typical day. Certainly 9/11 and what we dealt with the last couple days, that was not typical. There were no breaks associated with anybody's shift, and certainly the airspace issues were quite different.
Well, I'm sure that people have a lot of questions about how this operates. There was a special, in fact, on television last night about 9/11, and in the special they said that the FAA initially failed to communicate with the military on some things. Assuming that's true, has that been straightened out?
There was a lot of activity and some good reports that came out in the aftermath of that with some investigations that took place to see what went right, what went wrong, and a lot of those processes and procedures have been addressed and are in place now. So they did find quite a bit of things that they could fix and do better, but certainly for the most part, things with the exception of what the horrific events of that day, the aftermath and dealing with clearing of the airspace and then bringing it back up certainly went very well.
Well, I would imagine that there are a lot of times when air traffic controllers have some very bad days. Nothing really bad happens, but there was the possibility that it might, or the suspicion that there might be some incident.
Of that particular day?
I mean, just any day. There might be, you know, you might have some very bad days that we, the public, don't hear about.
Right. And with any kind of occupation that deals with things of this significant nature, life and death, you know, there's always that concern. NACA has a team along with the FAA, our critical incident stress management team. It is a group of peers that are trained in critical incident stress management, and they're available as peers to work with our members that have been involved with accidents or incidents to help them deal with that effectively and get back to work as soon as they're able to.
You said there are about 15,000 air traffic controllers, and I guess at any given time, 4,000 sort of in training?
Well, unfortunately, right now we have 4,000 in training because we've had a big turnover in our workforce. It would be better if we did not have that many in training. So right now it's very high because we've had a large amount of controllers retire in the last several years, and then so we had to hire quite a bit. That is largely because of the strike of 1981 when we hired, when 11,000 were fired, and then 10,000 or so replaced them all, you know, within a couple years.
That's right. So the retirement tsunami really did hit you guys. And when you go in as an air traffic controller, as you pointed out, with a mandatory retirement age of 56, you know really from day one how long you're going to last.
Correct. Yeah. And you should plan accordingly.
I bet they do. I imagine it's much like the military. People know these are certain rules. This is the way it's going to go. And so they do their career path accordingly. What's the salary range for air traffic controllers?
Well, it would depend on the type of facility that you are placed in and how long you've been in the agency. Certainly, our more senior controllers make more than our junior certified controllers. But at the academy, they make about $37,000 a year at the FAA Academy. Once they're placed in a facility, say they go to a level 7, which would be in Atlantic City, a Boise, Idaho, or Myrtle Beach, in their first developmental stage, they make about $44,000. When they're fully certified, about $66,000 a year. If they were to go to a level 12 instead, which we don't typically place out of the academy to a level 12, they go to the lower levels and then move their way up. But a level 12 is about $53,000 for developmental, which is a trainee, and then $103,000 when they're certified. And then on top of that, you know, all federal employees get locality pay depending on where they live. So that is placed on top of that. And certainly in our facilities where we have a lot of people still in training and not enough certified controllers, there is some overtime associated with those that are required to work longer shifts or, you know, 6 days in a row.
How about a New York or an Atlanta or Chicago? What would a fully experienced controller there earn?
About 103 to 105. Now, as they move up, they're going to get a little bit more for the cost of living. And as they move up through the pay scale, meaning the longer they're there, the more they'll make. So they could make, with overtime, they could make quite a bit more than a journeyman controller, somebody that just certified. Now, being that we have about 3,200 of our 15,000 eligible retire, those senior controllers are the higher earners. As they leave and they're replaced with the more junior certified controllers, that average goes down. But nationwide, the average is about $108,000 a year for
okay.
certified controllers.
Is 15,000 controllers, is that enough?
We do very well with the amount that we have. We are right now working with the agency collaboratively to look at the staffing needs of the facilities, taking into account attrition issues, the big retirement bubble that we are in right now because of the strike, and certainly the strain on the operation with trying to train so many, also dealing with trying to deploy all of the technologies that we are trying to get in place next gen with modernizing the system. And we're trying to come up with a true model that really points us to the adequate staffing in our facilities. I think we're very, very close. 15,000 is probably about right, 15,500. But certainly you don't want to go much below that. And hopefully with technology, we'll be able to enhance safety and do more, have more capacity in the air without having to increase controllers in the operation.
As a big-time baseball fan, I'm eternally grateful to you. You guys sponsor the radar gun at the Nationals games, don't you, that measures the speed of the pitches?
We do.
That is so neat. Thank you for that. And by the way, while we get it, what is NATCA? Tell me about NATCA.
NATCA is the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. We are the labor union that represents not just FAA air traffic controllers. We represent controllers in some of our DOD facilities and many of the controllers in our federal contract tower program. We also represent engineers and architects in the FAA and many, many other safety aviation professionals within the FAA, from drug abatement inspectors to aircraft certification inspectors to flight service station specialists up in Alaska to traffic management coordinators, many other aviation professionals. But, you know, while we are a labor union, we are very, very active in all aspects of the national airspace system, and we really, really are focused on the safe and efficient movement of aircraft through the system. So we are really strong advocates for improving safety, enhancing technology, and deploying appropriate equipment and procedures through the system so we can continue to operate a safe system for you.
Well, and talking about safety, despite the fact that you're more and more airplanes all the time, more people flying, it's getting safer, is it not?
It is getting safer, and that is a lot of work by a lot of entities, including ours, to make sure that we are able to not just handle the significant aircraft in the air today, but those that will hopefully be flying in the future as the system grows. Just to throw a couple stats at you, there are more than 2 million passengers fly through the system every single day with 70,000 flights a day. We contribute about $1.3 trillion, aviation does, to the economic activity of the country, which is about 5.2% of the GDP. So it is a very significant system, and it is very important that we all stay focused on the needs of the system and work together to make sure that we enhance safety every day.
Well, that jives with what they're saying about the gross domestic product and all that sort of thing, and how it's been impacted by several days of this hurricane on the East Coast, and the air traffic, it moves a lot of that.
Absolutely, as we see significant issues coming maybe very soon as January 3rd with sequestration, maybe those watching can see what the impact of this last 2 days has done to the country. It would be very similar to what may happen if those budget cuts were to take place in January.
Good point.
Good
point. Thank you, Trish Gilbert, from Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. We'll be right back in a minute here on Federal News Radio talking about sequestration. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey just had a fascinating discussion with Trish Gilbert. She's Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. And she left saying that what has happened over the weekend with Hurricane Sandy might be a touch of or a foretaste of what sequestration could mean to the FAA, to the flying public, to the economy. And joining me today from the Federal Times is Senior Writer Sean Riley. Sean, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Hey, that was a great segue for us because we wanted to talk about sequestration anyhow. And I noticed in Federal Times this week has a story from the Omaha World Herald, which I guess is part of the Federal Times family. Mm-hmm. And this is a very interesting story, John Bennett and Marcus Weisgerber talking about the president saying he was absolutely confident that a deal could be worked out where his sequestration would not happen. And during his during the third debate with Governor Romney, former Governor Romney, when the sequestration issue came up, he said it's not going to happen. And yet you have places like Politico here saying that there's the comments on the cuts flummox negotiators, and that they said the White House is backpedaling a little bit on that statement. What's your sense of this?
Well, at this point, I mean, sequestration, as the law has it, is going to happen starting January 2nd, unless the law has changed in some way. Now, the president's comments, latest comments, came in a what was supposed to be an what the White House originally said would be an off-the-record interview with the publisher and vice president for news at the Des Moines Register last week, where he was in which the president was seeking the newspaper's endorsement. After the paper made it public that the interview was off the record and questioned the rationale for that, the White House did release a transcript where it showed the president saying that he was, quote, absolutely confident, unquote, that you know, the White House and Congress can get the equivalent of the quote, of the grand bargain that would include spending cuts and some sort of revenue increases to that would be needed to avert sequestration. But he also said, quote, it will probably be messy, it won't be pleasant, unquote. So, you know, it's all going to come down to in about 2 weeks. A lame duck session is set to begin in Congress, regardless of who wins the presidential election. And there will definitely be a lot of posturing, a lot of negotiating. And obviously the White House hopes there will be ultimately a deal reached.
Well, that that story, and by the way, I think I said Omaha, it's the Des Moines Register, of course, but that story, which was off the interview, which was off the record and then was made on the record, said that, quoting here, says, but likely to the dismay of the defense industry and other sectors of the U.S. economy, the president seems to suggest that such a grand bargain with congressional negotiators will come during the first 6 months of the next presidential term. So that would mean if that is correct, that would mean instead of it not occurring January 2nd as the target date, that it could hit us and it could be going on as long as 6 months or longer.
Possibly. You know, there are even some people who say it should hit. You know, let sequestration begin on January 2nd. You know, the sky will probably not fall at that point. It's not like everyone's taxes are going to go up the next day, or that spending cuts, you know, the full force of the spending cuts we felt on January 3rd. So it's possible it could go on. It could go on to some extent into the, you know, into March, which is when the latest continuing resolution expires, or beyond that. It's ultimately up to Congress and the White House to what they can agree on. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that, under current law, to avert sequestration, there has to be an agreement on reducing future federal deficits through 2021 by $1.2 trillion. Now, unless you're assuming all of that's going to come from increased revenue, increased taxes, some of that is going to come from spending cuts. So it's, you know, most likely any kind of deal will include reductions in expected spending rates. But presumably they would not be as draconian and across the board as what's now looming with sequestration.
Well, that the payroll tax, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was reduced, I think, 2% a couple of years ago. That advantage is supposed to expire in January unless Congress and the White House extend it. Is that correct?
That is correct. And at this point, at least from what I'm reading in other media accounts, there is really very little interest in renewing that at this point, although the White House is reportedly, and it's a little, you know, reports are a little hazy on this account, or looking at some other kind of tax reduction that might, again, put more money in consumers' pockets and keep the recovery going. But at this point, again, based on best available information, it looks like that the Social Security tax cut will expire, the payroll tax cut will expire.
Right. So, and if it does, then people's overall income would go down about 2%?
That's right. I think I saw a number that it would the overall savings, I think average savings about $1,000 a year. So it's significant.
Great. All of the stuff we've been hearing from people, federal unions, contractor groups, pro-military groups, have all talked about the horrors of sequestration. The number of I've seen a political ad on television which says if it took place, something like 240,000 direct jobs would be eliminated by sequestration just in the state of Virginia, which of course is a purple state, a swing state, up for grab state.
Mm-hmm. And that's as you surely noticed, that has become an issue in the Senate race between former governors Tim Kaine and George Allen, because the impact would be felt most directly in states that benefit from a high ratio of federal spending. So that is, it's definitely gotten into the political conversation. At the same time, though, I think you have to keep in mind that agencies, at least quietly, are most likely doing some preparation, and as a result, some of the impacts might be mitigated and not be as severe as originally predicted. I always think back reductions in force that I've covered at various federal agencies. And invariably, they never turn out to be as bad as first predicted in terms of the actual number of people that are let go, because agencies always have positions they can eliminate that are unfilled at that point. They take action to slow hiring, and a report of that's already going on with some agencies now. And so they basically do some advanced preparation. That means when the full impact comes, it's not as bad as first expected.
Tell me more on sequestration with Sean Riley from the Federal Times. We'll take a short break here on Federal News Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey talking with Sean Riley. He is a senior writer for the Federal Times. And, Sean, before we let sequestration go away, I'm reminded, and I'll probably say it incorrectly, but victory has 1,000 fathers and defeat is always an orphan. All we've heard about sequestration is bad. How did it come to be, and who favors it?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's a subject of some dispute. It appears, as I understand it, if you read the latest of Bob Woodward's books, that the White House certainly had a hand in it. This borrows from an idea that was implemented back, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, again, as a way of achieving some deficit reduction when Congress couldn't bring itself to do it on its own. And the idea is essentially it's a forcing mechanism that automatic cuts kick in if Congress can't reach an agreement to take a more sculptured or tailored approach. But it's never been done. So the approach itself is not new, but to use it on this scale, where you're talking about 8-9% across the board cuts to most domestic discretionary and a large chunk of defense spending, military personnel excepted, would be unprecedented. As I think everyone agrees, Congress did enact this last year. President Obama signed it, but the assumption was that the consequences of sequestration actually going into effect would be so awful that all sides would reach an agreement beforehand to prevent it from taking place.
Kind of like, I guess, those poison pills you read about that some companies put in so they won't be taken over. This is sort of a reverse of that.
That is a perfect analogy, but of course this isn't a private company. This is the federal government.
This is the winning ball game. Listen, the Postal Service, I see you guys reported that some of the postal unions are unhappy about privatization.
Well, they're always concerned about that, and that, if you recall, that's one in the Republican Party platform this year. There was a reference, essentially, to privatizing some postal operations if, basically that's seen as appropriate, and that's certainly a concern. I mean, there's no specific proposal on the table at the moment by anyone that I'm aware of in Congress, and certainly not from the White House. But they're always looking over their shoulders, I think, about that. And certainly there have been some disputes between the unions and Postal Service management over contracting out certain operations. As you recall, there was, I think, pretty well documented that one thing that held up a buyout offer for clerks and other employees represented by the American Postal Workers Union was a dispute over whether the Postal Service was abiding by the terms of the contract agreed to last year that required it to bring some work that was being done by contractors back in-house, essentially by postal employees. And it's not quite clear how that was resolved or whether there was a connection, but certainly that was a factor. And we also reported this week that, campaign contributions by the four major postal unions are up this year versus 2 years ago, which perhaps isn't surprising considering that there was a presidential election this year versus 2 years ago, which was just the midterm congressional elections. But it is worth noting that that is occurring at the same time Congress is considering legislation that could have a significant impact on many employees in the Postal Service that are represented by these unions.
And I assume the unions, as they did in the earlier election, have endorsed President Obama for re-election.
I believe so, or if certainly they certainly have not endorsed Governor Romney. I'm not sure exactly what all of them have done. And overwhelmingly, their campaign contributions are going to Democrats, who typically tend to be their allies. But there are cases in which they do give to an occasional Republican. I think one recipient of some postal union money has been Representative Sam Graves, Republican, who sponsored a non-binding resolution essentially that has a majority of House members going on record as supporting continued Saturday mail delivery.
Frank Wolf of Northern Virginia, a Republican, has always been a sort of a favorite of the unions. They keep it quiet, but they seem to donate and quietly endorse him.
Yeah, well, I think he's, as you might expect with anyone, any member of Congress has a significant percentage of federal employees in his district. Congressman Wolf, I think, generally has been supportive of the federal workforce, or more so than a lot of Republican colleagues. I'm thinking specifically back to a couple months ago when it appeared that several thousand National Weather Service employees could be furloughed because there was a hang-up in reprogramming. Or in redirecting some money from various accounts in the Weather Service to the forecasting offices. Congressman Wolf, who chairs the relevant Appropriations Subcommittee, made it very clear that there weren't going to be any furloughs, and those furloughs did not happen.
Well, I know during both the Clinton and the Bush administrations, when President Clinton and President George W. Bush tried to hold down federal pay raises beneath the level called for by the Comparability Act, and in each case, Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland, a Democrat, and Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia, they would sort of play good cop, bad cop with the congressional leaders and push through higher pay raises. Of course, that hasn't happened this time, but that may be a reason he is highly regarded by them. Talking with Trish Gilbert, the Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Control Association, and she said they've been hit hard this year and last with retirements because of the mandatory retirement of 56. So if at least in the FAA, the retirement tsunami is here. Huh?
Yeah, and overall, I think my colleague Steve Losey earlier this month did a very good story looking at the data thus far this year. As you know, every the fifth of every month, the Office of Personnel Management releases a monthly summary of retirements. And the latest, which was released earlier this month, did show that retirements for 2012 are up both compared to 2010 and 2011. So it does appear, this long-predicted, but tsunami, which had always seemed to be on the cusp of happening but never actually did, now does seem to be materializing.
I know several people that have retired this year, even before the famous December 31st or January 3rd dates, which are very popular. But have you been talking to retirees or people who are going to retire? Are they telling you why?
Yeah, I think there's I think there are a number of factors. One is, the workforce generally is getting older, and you have all these baby boomers that came in decades ago, and they're now leaving. But you have factors, and to some extent this is speculation, but it certainly seems plausible. Thrift savings plan accounts that were clobbered by the stock market collapse a couple of years ago, those have had time to recover. You have the fact that there's been a federal pay freeze, in effect for the last 2 years. It's now going to go through at least March, and chances are things aren't going to get a lot better after that in terms of any significant increase in federal base pay. You have concern that there might be changes to federal pension programs that the pensions might be based on your highest 5 years instead of your highest three. I think some federal employees are just tired of constantly getting bashed, in Congress or by constantly having their work denigrated. So I think it's a variety of factors.
Well, this latest study, from the pro-government side, that said federal workers are underpaid by 32% or something like
34,
that.
34, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I love the range. Some say they're overpaid by 40%, and some say they're underpaid by 32%. So that's more than your regular 3% margin of error.
And it just depends on how you measure it. It was interesting. There's a project going on by two public administration organizations that recently came out with a paper which suggested getting rid of across-the-board pay raises for general schedule employees in favor of increasing the range within particular bands within particular grades.
Here we go again.
Yeah, you've heard this before.
Yes. Sean, listen, thank you so much, Sean Riley from Federal Times. Remember, our shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime. This is a very good hour today. Thank you for being with us. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.
Thanks, Mike.